This is Starters for the Rest of Us, episode 159. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Rob?
The word is I'm 1 week past the public launch of Drip, and it feels like a lot has happened during that time. Basically, last Wednesday, we launched to the last 1,400 people on the email list and then went live with the world. It feels good. It feels like a good milestone. However, the day that I sent out the emails, or it was about the day before, we started having some performance issues. I think we talked briefly about them on the last podcast. And so I couldn't like relish in the victory of the launch because I was basically having to go in and like disable reports for people who had higher volume accounts, which are our best customers, frankly, right? It's the people with the most traffic who are sending the most emails. So that was bittersweet. But within 2 days, we went to a new server, got a new AWS instance with an egregious amount of RAM, moved the database over in the middle of the night on Friday night. And at that moment, everything came back up and it was super fast. That was when it was literally 1 a.m. Saturday morning. That's when I finally had like the victory rush of we're done, we're launched and stable. And then I popped off this quote today to Derek and he thought this was funny. I said, when my app is unstable, I'm unstable. And I think I'm going to put that on a t-shirt at some point.
Very nice. Well, it's nice to be able to have those performance problems and then you already have the customer signed up and be able to turn around and invest in a better infrastructure for that. But it kind of sucks that you have to go through all the stress and effort of moving everything over just because you end up with those performance issues.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, it's this balance, right? Because the server we moved to is going to amortize out over the course of a year. It's going to be between $400 and $500 a month for the database server. That's what we need to sustain growth, what I expect the growth to be over the next year. And I wouldn't have wanted that 6 months ago. You know, this that would have saved us all the headache, but we'd just been dropping tons of cash along the way. This is now the second server we've upgraded to. And I think this is the beauty of these kind of pay-as-you-go models. You can scale up pretty easily. You just have to have that 20 minutes of shutdown time, you know, where as long as your database is small enough, because it's only 2 or 3 gigs still, you only need 20 minutes to do it. And if you can get to it quick and you have an agile team, this is the startup way, right? This is not, if I was at a big enterprise, I would have just dropped the coin 6 months ago and gotten a 68 gig instance for the database. But it's just not something I want, you know, you want to spend when you have zero customers using it, but it's totally warranted when you have, you know, a couple hundred people actively pounding on this thing.
Well, I'm testing out a new task prioritization strategy. So I've had so many things coming in that like my, I think I'm like most people where I tend to use my email box as, I tend to use Gmail as a kind of a task list. And I try to keep it under like 20 or 30 things, but lately it started to grow and become a little bit more unwieldy. And, you know, getting to that inbox zero has just not been feasible lately. So what I've started doing was I picked up a couple of ebooks. They were written by Steve Pavlina. We'll link to his blog on the show notes. One of the books that I picked up was some advice on productivity. And one of the things that I took out of that book was he actually sets up a system so that he has A tasks, B tasks, and C tasks. And anything that's an A task is stuff that will generate some sort of return or still be usable within in 5 years. And anything that's a B task will have like a life expectancy of 2 years. And then anything that's a C task, you know, the benefits are going to be no more than 90 days in the future. So anything that's like paying bills or doing invoicing or sending out receipts and things like that, those are all C tasks. They need to be done, but they're not necessarily important. And they are not going to benefit you, you know, 90 days down the road, really. I mean, obviously, you've got to pay your bills and stuff versus things like working on your core products or building marketing material and things like that. Those could be B or even A level tasks. And he actually suggests that you spend at least 50% of your time on A level tasks and no more than, I think, around 20% of your time on your C tasks. And then everything else kind of gets shuffled in with the B tasks. So at a bare minimum, you're spending at least 4 hours a day on your A-level tasks. At most, you're spending maybe an hour and a half on your C-level tasks, and then any leftover time gets allocated to your B-tasks. And it seems like that I kind of separated out my task list according to that strategy, and I'm kind of working through it right now. And it seems like it might actually work out because I can take a look at anything that's a C-level task. My very first thought is, can I send this to somebody else to do?
Yeah, that's a nice way to do it. I'm actually intrigued by this because what I have is a queue in Trello that pretty much are my tasks. And I just have a single queue and I keep it in order and I try to go down that queue as best as I can. And then, of course, stuff gets assigned to me in Fogbugs for support and stuff gets emailed to me in Gmail. And so I really do have three queues that I'm trying to merge and manage. And I try to get everything into Trello, prioritize, and then handle it. But I don't like killing 20% of my time just trying to manage the queue. So sometimes, of course, you just go into email and delete a bunch of stuff and reply quickly without adding it into Trello. So I like the idea of having an A and a B and maybe a C, because then those tasks that I'm always prioritizing at the bottom that never get done, a lot of my probably B and C tasks are down there. You can actually give yourself permission to go work on them, right? These are less important tasks, but they do need to get done at some point. What I'm wondering is, what tool are you using to manage this? Like, are you putting everything in a spreadsheet, or is there a better way? Because you still have an email inbox with 20 things in it. How do you know what's an A and a B and a C?
Well, I haven't really gotten through my list of emails yet, but I've basically been keeping track of a list of what I classify as my A, B, and C tasks. And some of the emails in my mailbox map back to these. So, like, for example, I have pay bills on here. I have sent work to one of my contractors. That's a B-level task because it's more important that I keep him busy, because the things that he's working on are going to contribute to the business in the future, and they will have that impact down the road. And then there's things like soliciting more users for Audit Shark, validating and testing some of the Audit Shark code and working on that core engine. I've classified as A-level tasks. A lot of the emails that are in my mailbox map back to those high-level things. It's not like, you know, I'm going through my email box right now and just saying, this is an A-level email, this is a B-level email, or something like that. I'm keeping track of things separately on an index card, because I tend to use a lot of index cards just to keep track of things that I have to do that I need to do today, for example. And what I did was I just mapped out a bunch of things that I have on my list of things to do, and I just put A, B, or C next to each of them.
Got it. So for you, it seems like a shorter term thing, because that's not going to work for tasks over the course of weeks or months to have them on index cards, right? Because then you have to rewrite it all the time.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times what I'll do is I'll throw a bunch of tasks on an index card. And my goal is to get through that entire index card, and then I just throw it away.
Right.
And that's the whole point of having an index card, because you want to get through it. And it tends to be a short enough list, because you can only fit so much stuff on an index card that it helps you knock those things out. And if you absolutely need to, you can take things from one index card and copy them onto another and put them at the top of the list or something like that. But I try to avoid doing that if I can.
I did that for a while. I didn't like it. Felt like a lot of wasted time. It was hard to reprioritize. Like I said, when Trello started and I started using it, I've been sold and I've been using it since. I have maintained Inbox Zero. I got to Inbox Zero right before going to Europe. And then I was gone for a month. I came back to hundreds and hundreds of emails, and I'm down. I think I'm at Inbox 5 as of the start of this recording. I'm pretty close to there, and I am able to get most of the things into Trello. What's nice is that Trello now has an email address unique for your board. So in Gmail, I can just hit forward, and I've listed as the contact name is Trello. And so I type in Trello, hit send, and it goes into at the top of my Trello board. And so then when I go into Trello to look at stuff, I'm able to reprioritize things. And then basically I have to go back into Gmail and find it. I mean, that's where the kludge part comes in, right? Is I'm using these two systems to manage that single thing. But for me so far, it's working. I do think there's a better way. The better way, I think, would be to make a cross between Gmail and Trello, right? Make a plugin where you could reorder things in your Gmail inbox, right? And add notes and add things just like Trello, but do it to Gmail emails right there. You could add metadata and reorder so that they're not just sorted by date. That's what I think the best option would be.
Switch over to using something like Fogbugs or some other sort of, you know, quote unquote bug tracking tool or customer support tool where, like, you send and receive all your emails out of there. Yep. And then that allows you to add in all those notes. But that's a total hack as well.
Yep, I mean, it is. No, but I could see that working. I wanted to call out a website called beamcalculations.co.uk. This is from a longtime listener and a guy who read my book and implemented a lot of the stuff that we talk about. His name is Kevin Taylor, And he's at BeamCalcs on Twitter. He said, Rob Walling, the site I had built, beamcalculations.co.uk, after reading your book, it's been live since September 25th and it's had 16 sales. Great thanks to you. So just wanted to, you know, kind of call him out as a nice success story of someone who was able to launch. And he's certainly not going to retire off this effort, but it's that stair-step approach. It's getting something out there, getting people to use it, getting your feet wet and getting some experience marketing and actually getting a few dollars in your bank account. And once you get that feeling, it's addictive. Like launching is addictive, you know? And so getting this site out, I bet, will lead to his next idea and his next one. And they tend to get bigger over time. So big congratulations to Kevin on launching.
Since you were out during the middle of Business of Software, I figured we'd go over some of the takeaways from Business of Software this year.
So you've broken it up into, you have the hallway track, and then you have a few speakers that you took away quite a few things from, it sounds like. So why don't you lead us through that?
The first one was the hallway track, and this is just randomly talking to people in the hall and various conversations, whether you're sitting down at lunch or you sit down in the amphitheater and talk to somebody next to you. I was talking to, I believe it was Brecht Palumbo, who was telling me that one of the things that he's found is that when he's trying to reach out and contact people, the best way that he's found is to use LinkedIn. Within LinkedIn, you can send direct messages to people. I apologize if I'm misquoting the numbers and stuff, but I believe it was something in excess of 70 or 80% in terms of the open rate, and a response rate was something along the lines of 50% for people who are receiving those emails, which I think is a far cry from what you would typically get if you're just cold emailing people or sending out marketing newsletters and things like that.
Right. Well, the interesting thing here is you have the social graph. So you're probably tied to this person either directly or as a second level or a third level connection. So it's not a super cold email. There might be a little bit of warmth there. And I'd be interested to hear more detail about this. Maybe I'll drop Breck an email, but I'm curious to hear how you do this and don't come off as spammy or solicity or just out of the blue salesy type thing. I know that there's a balance here and I'm sure you can get there. I'm just curious what the lessons learned are there.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about that, and it was more about when you're first reaching out to somebody, you don't necessarily say, hey, I've got this product to sell you or that I think that you might be interested in. It seemed like the best way to reach out to people was to ask them questions, say, hey, I noticed that you're listed over here or you're involved in this organization. You know, I'd love to have a conversation with you about it and talk to you a little bit about it or something along those lines.
Very cool.
So the next one was from Rita Gunther, and it was very interesting because Rita's talk seemed very reminiscent of Clayton Christensen's. One of the things that Clayton talks a lot about is disruptive technologies and how companies that are large tend to be attacked from underneath by the smaller companies because they're not really paying attention to them, or it's a very disruptive technology and they don't feel like it's going to be relevant in their space. He kind of relates that back to the story of IBM, how they were initially selling these giant mainframe computers and then switched over to mini computers while all of their competitors went out of business because they spun up this new division in this completely different part of the country. And a lot of the things that she talked about was how to identify some of the markets that are ripe for new competitors. And she said, basically, find companies that have hostages, not customers, because those are the people who are locked in. And the only reason they haven't gone to find another provider is because they can't.
Yeah, I've talked to a few people who are interested in Drip, some guys I know, and they've talked about some larger enterprise marketing software that they're using. They're saying that they're basically not able to sign up without a one-year contract, that they are essentially hostages for a year, that even if they just want to try it out, I mean, they get the, you know, you get a two-week trial or a three-week trial, but after that, you either pay for a year or you can't use the software. And I know Salesforce is like that, and I think the larger enterprise like HubSpot is all annual. And I understand that it's, you know, it's better for their business and for their retention and everything, but it really does make your customers at some point start to turn against you. You see these companies early on where they have big fans, and I think Salesforce and HubSpot have both been in that situation. You know, Intuit was like that when they had their tax software that was really good and everybody loved it. And then at a certain point, it feels like they're just trying to milk money out of you and they have you locked into their ecosystem. So I like the way of thinking about that. If you spot a company or an industry where everybody's a hostage, I think credit card processing, right, the payment gateways and all that stuff definitely was like that. And Stripe came in and said, everybody's a hostage. How can we improve that? I like this approach.
the credit card companies is one that she specifically called out because nobody really likes dealing with those companies, but they kind of have to because they really just don't have any other choice. And as you said, until Stripe came along and then all these other payment providers came out and started offering other types of solutions, so you don't necessarily need to have a payment gateway anymore. Something else that she had talked about was in identifying some of these markets is if the bosses at these companies have a tendency to say one of three things, either one, I don't want any surprises, two, don't bring me bad news, or three, don't bring me a problem unless you have a solution. Because a lot of times those are the types of companies, especially for number three, if the boss says, I don't want to hear about problems unless you have a solution for it. Well, if you have a company that can come in underneath them and basically get them from down low, from like, you know, below their price point or something along those lines, if you don't have a solution for that, then what will happen is if there's that sort of culture in that company, nobody's going to bring it to the boss's attention that it's going to be a problem for them because they don't have a solution. So if the boss has kind of made that mandate, nobody's going to approach him until it's way too late and you've basically already done the damage to them.
So how would you know that about a company? You'd have to get some type of anecdotal evidence, or you'd have to have some type of business relationship with them at your day job and realize how screwed up they were and then kind of go on the side and build a product to compete with them?
Well, I think you could do it a couple of different ways. I mean, one, you could certainly probably glean some of that information out of just the way that they do business. And I think some of that would trickle down into their customer service. But definitely talking to former employees would probably be, you know, just kind of a no-brainer to me. I mean, if you can find some ex-employees of the company and kind of ask them questions about that, especially if you're already looking at going after a particular market and you happen to run into one of them and you start asking them questions like that and say, hey, how do you guys, or how did you analyze your competitors and what sorts of things did they do internally and how was it operated? I almost feel like the larger companies that suffer some backlash, like you were saying before about Salesforce and some of these other companies where they're really locking in their customers, I sort of suspect that in some ways their internals of the organization are probably run very similarly, where it's just very heavy-handed from the top and you're expected to follow orders, not necessarily be nimble. It's like they want you to do what you're told to do and not necessarily think out of the box because they're trying to drive revenue in the way that they know how versus look for alternatives and other solutions.
Yeah, I think there's that part where you can over-optimize your funnel or you can over-optimize your retention and you try to push churn down for, typically it's reasons of going public, right? Or of trying to please shareholders or investors. I often find that founders don't want to do this kind of stuff, but you hit a point where, in my opinion, you can just push it too far, and that's when you start pissing off customers, and there starts being this movement away from you, and that's where competitors can sneak into a market. Identifying companies who have hit that point are good markets for us to enter.
The next person I took a bunch of notes from was Dan Soroka from Optimizely. And he essentially had five different lessons that he wanted people to take away from his talk. And the first one was defining quantifiable success. Because if you're not familiar with Optimizely, it's essentially an A-B testing tool for your website. And the first lesson was defining quantifiable success. If you're running any sort of tests, you want to understand what are the success measures. How are you going to know whether or not a particular test was successful? And some of that with A-B testing just comes in terms of knowing whether a test is statistically significant or not. The second lesson was that less is more. And if you reduce the number of choices that people have, then you can get a lot more return on the choices that you've made to implement. So for example, there were several examples that he put up there where, like for example, the checkout process, what people would do is they would rip out all of the site navigation. Some people take this for granted that, oh, well, that seems like a no-brainer. But then there's other people who look at that and say, oh, well, I wouldn't have known that would have given me a 17% increase in my conversion rate, for example. He made sure to call out some things like that. The third lesson that he brought was that words matter. And he showed several different examples where he was putting different types of text on buttons and asking the audience to kind of weight their opinion on what they thought would do better. And there were a lot of people who in the audience, I mean, I would probably say it was 60 or 70% who were wrong on most of these. That was something else that was very interesting as well, is because words really do matter. And he was able to statistically show that there were certain types of words that would show up on buttons that would have a huge increase in the number of click-throughs. And in addition to that, depending on the audience, for example, if somebody was a new visitor to the website, one set of text might convert better versus somebody who was coming in from a mailing list or had purchased before, a different set of text would have a much better conversion rate.
You know, this stuff can get complicated. And I think that if you are sitting here listening to this and you're kind of licking your chops because you have a successful business and you're looking to squeeze another few percentage points out of it, then this kind of, it's advanced testing and analytics is what it is. This type of stuff is awesome. If you're just getting started and you have 1 or 2,000 uniques to your website or you're still building your product, then don't worry about this yet. I mean, A/B testing is far off for you at this point, and certainly these high-end, ultra optimizations, as I would say, because yeah, if you have traffic, let's say you have 1 million uniques a month, then it is absolutely worth optimizing every button for, like you said, the traffic source, like actually changing the text on buttons for traffic source. Amazon.com does this. Google does this. I mean, those high volume scaled sites, certainly, you know, it's worth it for them. But I'd advise a listener to not go down the rabbit hole of worrying about stuff prematurely. Basically, it's kind of like premature optimization in that sense. With that said, you know, if you do have a successful business, you have something that's, you know, maybe allowed you to quit your job, and you haven't gone through a round of optimization, of tweaking words, of testing different approaches, of reducing choices, kind of following the things that Dan talked about in this talk, it can do pretty amazing things for you very quickly. Double-digit jumps in conversion rates, double-digit jumps in sales. Even just having someone that you trust come and do a 10-minute screencast review of your onboarding process and walking through that can give you 20 different ideas to implement and can dramatically increase the number of people that actually use your app. We've gone through this already 2 or 3 times with Drip. And one of the big reasons is because we're emailing that mailing list of several thousand people who I knew were going to come and hit these pages. The pages just, you know, some weren't converting and a lot of people weren't onboarding early on. There were a lot of questions. And so we've already gone through the reduced choices as you're trying to get set up. And I had a lot of different options for getting set up, and now it's basically whittled down to like 2.5 options. There's a lot of value to be had here, I think.
The last two pieces of advice that Dan had was seeking the global maximum, because a lot of people have a tendency when they're doing A/B testing to tweak little things as opposed to doing wholesale changes to a page or to a site, for example, just because it's so much more difficult to figure out what piece of that redesign, for example, impacted the conversion rates, or was it just one thing? You know, obviously, if a lot of things change, it's very difficult to pin it down to exactly what it was. But you may very well be missing out on a lot of sales, for example, if you don't do this and you end up with a local maximum for your click-through rates, because you've got all these things that are kind of leading you down a path to an overall 8% increase in conversions. But if you did a complete site redesign, then you may very well find that something completely different could give you a 20% lift instead of just an 8%. But it is a huge risk if you start doing those things.
Yeah, you also need a lot of traffic to do that. I've only had one site that I've ever been able to actually test two very different versions of a page and not just test them against one another, but tweak both of them and do essentially multivariate testing over time and actually raise both of their conversion rates and then seeing which one won out. And that's how you'd find the global maxima. But it is, one, super time intensive, and two, you need a lot of traffic or else it just takes too long. So this is another thing I'd say, you know, save for later unless you do have a lot of traffic coming your way.
The last lesson that he had to share was just start doing A/B testing today, which, as Rob just said, I mean, you really do need to have a lot of traffic in order to make this worth it. I mean, part of Optimizely was really built out of a lot of things that were learned from, you know, the campaign trail from Obama's 2008 campaign towards the White House. So there's a lot of examples from the book that Dan points out. He gave a copy of his A/B testing book to everybody in the audience, which has a lot of the examples from that campaign and from various other things that they've seen and other companies that they've worked with. But you're right. I mean, you do need a lot of traffic in order to be able to do some of these things. Someone else I took a lot of information from was Scott from Atlassian. There were several different things that he put out there, one of which was that internally when they're developing features, I thought it was really interesting that what they do is they create customer personas with very specific attributes and, you know, goals and job titles for those customer personas to help the team understand how the software is going to be used out in the wild. So you're not just building feature X, you're building feature X that is going to be used by, I don't know, Sally in accounting, whose job title is CPA for the company or something, or maybe she's a CFO. She's going to be the one who's going to be using this particular feature. So she needs to be able to understand it, and it needs to relate directly to her job. Whereas, you know, Dan, who's over in the marketing department, is completely not going to care about that feature, but, you know, it's going to help Sally, which will indirectly help him. Another thing that they do to help keep the team not just interested, but, you know, on the same page, is to explain why those features are useful rather than how great those features are at a technical level, because it's really important to the end user that those features work and help them do their jobs. They don't necessarily care about, you know, how technically challenging it was to implement or how much goes on under the covers. They want to know what it helps them do.
Benefits, not features, right?
Yeah, benefits, not features. Something I found really interesting that Scott said was that he felt like at least 50% of the people there at the conference should go back to the office and fire someone. And he said that everyone knows there's someone they shouldn't keep, but they do because they don't want to confront the problem. It was interesting that somebody would put that out there in the way that
he did.
Yeah,
there's a book called Fire Someone Today, and I haven't read it, but I've had it recommended to me. And it's the same premise, is that, you know, you should fire someone because you're not facing up to something. And I would think of it as like letting someone go who's underperforming. But it's like, if you've grown to 10 people and you've never let anyone go, have you really hired that well? Or, you know, I can see his point that maybe you're just ignoring the facts that are in front of you. This one's probably less applicable to me.
There were several reasons that he pointed out that why you might want to let someone go. And one of them was if they were a bad culture fit. Bad performance was another one. But he also commented that sometimes the company just grows past people. And I think this really heavily applies more to Atlassian than a lot of other companies, just because at this point, Atlassian is, I think, 700 or 800 employees. And 10 years ago, they were, you know, just a couple of guys working on a product. And, you know, it's a very different company when you've got 10 people versus 100 people or very close to 1,000 people. And somebody who was there in the first year or the second year, they may have been very, very comfortable leading a team that was only 5 or 6 people. But then, you know, you get into that problem where some people, if you're just not cut out to be in a company that has grown to the point that it is, then maybe it's time for you to either move on or to move to a different role inside of the company. And that's something else that he commented. He's like, just because they're not a good fit for their current role anymore doesn't mean you can't look elsewhere inside the company. There may be other things that they can do, and they will certainly be appreciative of that fact, but nobody really wants to come to their boss and say, hey, look, I'm really not a good fit for this company anymore. You know, they're going to go out and look for another job before they start doing that.
There's a book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There, and it applies more to growing a company as a founder and the skills that got you here and the marketing approaches and all that. If you've 10x'd, they won't take you the next 10x. You have to change your tactics. But I think that applies equally to growing an organization.
Yeah, he said that it's a very different culture when people are getting hired without the founder's involvement, because the culture in the early days very much revolves around the founders. And then once the founders are no longer doing all of the hiring, that's at the point where you have to have like core values for the company and things like that, where you have to have, you know, written down what your culture is for the company in order to be able to scale that out to other people. Something Scott had talked about was, he said that in terms of pricing, you get eaten from below, not from above, which kind of related back to Rita's talk about how to find markets that are, you know, ripe to be plundered. What he did was he looked around at some of the other companies that were selling similar types of software, and he realized that their software was actually priced significantly higher than their competitors. So what he did was he essentially looked around and said, okay, well, how can we combat this? How can we fight this sort of pricing strategy that could ultimately be our downfall? And what they ended up doing was they created these very small team packages for people, and they sold easily 6 figures worth of software within like a couple of weeks. And all that money got donated to charity, so it wasn't necessarily about the money for them. But it was just interesting how in demand that software was, based on the small team sizes of, like, you know, it was next to free for like 5 or 10 people. I think it's $5 $5 or $10 or something like that.
Yeah, this is where I think they do Jira this way, right? Or they do a bundle of Jira, which is their issue tracker, with something else. And it's like you said, it's like thousands of dollars of tools, but they are basically trying to eat up the market. They're almost going freemium, basically. I guess it's on-premise, huh? So it's like $10 and you've just bought a license to it for up to 5 or 10 people. And they're just trying to destroy the lower end market because that's not where their bread and butter is. And I'll say it gives them a competitive advantage because it allows them to get people on board with their tool. And then as that company grows, then hopefully they'll be more likely to use Atlassian stuff rather than start with some SaaS competitor who just upsprouted and has a couple million in funding, who's also trying to take that same market share from them.
Two other points that Scott had made were both about how to price your offerings, because they do have a hosted solution and they do have a on-premise solution that they give. The point that he made was that when you sell something that is more valuable over time, use a subscription model. And if you sell something that becomes less valuable over time, get your money up front.
Do you have examples of something that becomes more valuable versus less valuable? Did he bring up any?
He didn't specifically, but think about this, for example, a bug tracking system. If you have a bug tracking system, over time that gets more valuable to the customer, because over time, as you add hundreds of bugs or thousands of bugs and cases in there, you don't necessarily want to lose all that history. So moving to another product at that point, that product that you're currently on becomes more valuable to you because it has all of that history. Now, if you look at something like, you know, an ebook, you're essentially delivering all of the value up front, and as the person learns from that and consumes it, there's not really anything else. So getting your money up front is obviously the natural course for that. And I don't know as we necessarily think about those types of things when we are putting together the offerings. The easiest way to explain
it. Perfect. Yep, those are good examples. So in terms of BOS, you've gone every year for the past 3 or 4 years. Do you feel like it's changed for you, or are you still getting the same value out of it that you always have?
It was really high for a little while, and then it dropped down a little bit, and I think it's starting to pick back up
again. Got it. So this year was perhaps better than last year?
I would definitely say that this year was better than last year, and I think that part of that was just because the arrangement of the talks and stuff. So they had this back at the Seaport Hotel, so there was the amphitheater.
It's also smaller now, right?
Yeah, they cut a bunch of people from it. They didn't sell nearly as many tickets this year as they did last year. I think last year they sold around 450 people, and I think this year was around 350. So it was definitely smaller, but it didn't necessarily feel any smaller this year than it did last year.
That's interesting. Yeah, because you and I have had some conversations about selling a few more MicroConf tickets, like maybe 20 more than last year, and just growing a little bit and allowing us some flexibility to keep increasing the value of the conference. And my gut is that that's not going to change the feel of it. But going from where, you know, the first year I went to BOS, it was 200 or 225 people. And so for it to be 450, that's a very different conference.
Yeah, definitely. And it just felt different last year to right. This year. I felt like this year's conference probably delivered more value than last year's conference.
That's good. Yeah, I haven't been for the last 2 years. This year was because I was in Europe. Last year, I just opted not to go because the year before, I hadn't gotten very much out of the conference. I mean, it was disappointing. I've always been, like, BOS has always been my number one conference. 3 years ago, it was a little less, and then 2 years ago, you know, it wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. So I haven't gone. Sounds like it has potentially reverted course, you know, in terms of the fact that it's smaller now. I do think that the hallway conversations are probably going to be the bulk of the value, and I just need to come to grips with that I'm basically using it as a reunion, you know, to see a bunch of MicroConf Vegas people halfway through the year, and that's okay. But I'll probably focus on that rather than on the sessions. The sessions and the speakers that they've had are for such large companies. Like HubSpot's going public, Atlassian has 700 employees. It's very different than, you know, what it was 3 or 4 years ago. For someone like me who never plans to go there, you know, go to that level of having a company that large, you know, I'll go for the hallway track and meet up with people who I know from MicroConf.
That was another interesting thing that I found, was there were probably about 30 people there that I knew from MicroConf or from, you know, the Micropreneur Academy. So there was a lot of, you know, hallway discussions about various things that people were working on or things that we'd learned or different techniques. And it wasn't so much focused on the talks and what we were getting out of them as it was like the other things we were doing. So it was very much, as you said, kind of a mini reunion halfway through the year.
Yeah, that's a nice way to do it. And then what's cool is you get in those conversations and you say, what are you up to? You know, how's AutoTruck doing, or what's working for you with your product? And then someone says, oh, I did this crazy campaign on whatever. And you're like, oh, I totally need to try that, you know? Or someone said, hey, I had a marketing idea for you and it's to integrate with so-and-so. It worked for me. Those are the tips that will make a difference in your business.
I think the last one that I want to bring up is from Greg Bagus, and I apologize because I know he listens to this show, so if I butchered your last name, I'm sorry. He had a very good talk that, and something happened that I'd never seen at Business of Software before, but he gave his talk, and it was on entrepreneurs and depression. It was related to his struggles with ADHD and being bipolar. He got a standing ovation at the end of it. I've never seen anyone at Business of Software get a standing ovation before. It was a very heartfelt talk, and it brought to light, I think, a lot of issues that most people just don't talk about in the entrepreneur community, because building a business is hard and there's a lot of struggles that people go through. And for the most part, you tend to be alone. It's if you have employees, it's not like you're going to talk to your employees about certain things. And, you know, who else are you going to talk to about them? It was very interesting to hear about his story and have somebody get up there and talk about that particular topic.
Yeah, bravo to Greg. I actually have the video has already been released to the public. If you go to businesssoftware.com. It should be somewhere around there. I think sharing a story like that is a really big deal, and I think it's helpful for a lot of people. This issue is coming up more and more. I don't think it's going away. These are successful and failed founders, and talking about very real things that come up in the struggles of starting a company. I think it's helpful, and there have literally been suicides of venture funded founders who the pressure just gets to them, or the stress just activates something in them, and this is not something that I guess is uncommon, and it's kind of coming to light. Talked to Sherry about it quite a bit. My wife. She's a PhD in psychology, and she has talked to a few founders who are experiencing this kind of stuff, and she's actually interested in the topic. And we had at one point talked about her doing some research and doing a talk on it. So I think there's some more to be said on this topic, and I really appreciate Greg for kind of bringing it to light and sharing it in such a personal way, because I'm sure, as I said, it resonates with a lot of us. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.